Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Frank, the producer, has generously allowed me to know whether our guest was or when it was not here about a second and a half before the program, the second segment began, and James Corbett is here. All right. I'm going to make Frank pay for that one way or another. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but he got to give me that word in advance. Otherwise, I get anxious about these things. I don't know whether the guest is or is not here, and it puts me in a state of high anxiety. I feel like Mel Brooks. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing a lot better than you, I guess. I'm doing pretty good.
I'm doing fine. Good. This is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. James has been living in Japan for the past decade. He's published the Corbett Report since 2007, if I recall correctly. And James is interesting because I'm trying to think of, are there subjects that we can talk about, James, that you don't have any background in?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm having a hard time. Yeah, I'm sure that's true for everybody, but you're knowledgeable about a lot of different items and knowledgeable in depth. And that's what surprises me. We have a hard time. I have a hard time finding questions for James that James can't speak on extensively and articulately. So let's try another episode. What's happening in Hong Kong? And what I mean in particular, I've seen one report that the people of Hong Kong don't feel like they're part of China. Do you think that's, it wouldn't be everybody, but they feel like they're not part of China. They don't want to be part of China. Is that a significant percentage of the population that feels that way, or is it an exaggerated report? And has everything calmed down?
Well, I wouldn't say that people have calmed down. I wouldn't say that that's an exaggerated report. I think that the people in Hong Kong clearly see themselves as quite different than mainland Chinese. And specifically, I mean, there's all sorts of cultural differences, historical differences, political differences, and even linguistic differences that separate Hong Kong and Beijing. So I think that there obviously it is a unique culture within the Chinese society, I guess, under that Chinese umbrella. Speaking of umbrellas, I mean, obviously the protests are still going on, the so-called umbrella revolution, and it's quite interesting to watch this develop because it certainly is a pattern that we've seen in a lot of similar types of revolutions that have taken place in recent years, Arab Spring and others, where there is clearly and has been and continues to be outside influence in what's going on there. And a number of commentators in the alt media have pointed to the connections of some of the so-called self-appointed leaders of the Occupy Central movement as being connected to the National Endowment for Democracy and the U.S. State Department's favorite NGO and other such organizations that have shady links to various Washington-connected political think tanks and what have you. And those types of connections, as I say, have popped up in all of these color revolutions and things that we've seen in numerous different countries over the years. But I'm starting to become a little bit disheartened by the level of analysis that I've seen in a lot of these alt media reports, because I certainly do agree that there's no doubt that the United States State Department and its various organs and connected interests certainly do have a vested interest in seeing the Hong Kong and China tension exacerbated and seeing further destabilization on the peripheries of Chinese society, because that ultimately works towards the foreign policy interests of the U.S. State Department. And it's sort of long war with China that it's simmering under the surface right now. And I get all of that, and that's been well documented and deservedly so. But at the same time, I think of this from the perspective of someone in Hong Kong who, for example, I mean, part of what's going on here is the Beijing is coming in and saying we are going to pre-select the candidates for the 2017 election, which supposedly had been guaranteed to be part of a universal suffrage election that was going to be selecting the chief executive of Hong Kong, like the the president or prime minister or what have you of Hong Kong, which, of course, isn't a country. It's a special administrative region. That election was supposed to be universal suffrage and was supposed to be basically anyone could run. But now Beijing is coming along and saying, nope, well, we will select who will be allowed to run. And so, I mean, that's there's obviously a lot more to the story, but that's sort of the immediate impetus for what we're seeing right now. And you see the alt media analysis of this going, well, look, this is just Washington interfering and trying to sponsor. But I look at this from the perspective of people in Hong Kong who it really does seem to me that the if we follow the logic of a lot of these alt media commentators, then basically if a country is being targeted by the U.S. State Department apparatus, like China obviously is, then the people who are in that system, who are living in that country, cannot, should not, in any way protest against what that government is doing to it, because that's working in Washington's policy interests, which is a ridiculous way of looking at it. I think that the people suffering under oppression from the oppressive Beijing government have every bit as much right to be absolutely outraged about their position as people in the United States have to complain about the suffering and the oppression that they're suffering under Obama, for example. Absolutely as much right. Human freedom is a human thing, and I think that it's kind of short-sighted of a lot of the alt media to focus on this in as if the people of Hong Kong should only care about the U.S. and its State Department goals when they're talking about what is actually happening to them under the oppressive Beijing government. So it's complicated. There's a lot going on, but I think that the underlying narrative is that that people in Hong Kong generally, a lot of them, are fed up with Beijing, and I think deservedly so.
Well, it's interesting to wonder, why is our government willing to attempt to stir the hornet's nest in Hong Kong? They can't imagine that they're not going to get caught. They can't imagine. If that's what they're doing, they have to know it's going to be exposed and it will antagonize China. And you used the language, the long war with China, to describe the American government's relationship with China. So where are we really with China? Is this just open, not a kind, are we dealing with a kind of cold war with China, even though we're doing a lot of business with them? Is there a cold war going on where we're trying to needle them, they're trying to needle us? And is it going to get hotter, stay cold? What's going to happen here?
Well, Alfred, did you ever watch Star Trek? The original series?
Yes.
Yes. And you might you might recall that Spock used to occasionally play a game of three-dimensional chess. And yes. They never really explained the rules of this, but they showed the board, and there are different levels on the board. Basically, it's like a chessboard, but split into different levels, and I guess the pieces can move upward and downward as well as left and right. And the idea is that I think there's a two-dimensional chess game taking place geopolitically and a three-dimensional chess game. And we can look at the two-dimensional chessboard and think we know what's going on. But if we don't understand that this is a three-dimensional chess game, we're going to lose that chess game every single time because we just don't understand the bigger rules of what's happening. So I think the two-dimensional chess game of what's happening right now is that China and the U.S. are involved in a Cold War-type scenario where the U.S. State Department is using its various apparatus, and obviously NATO is involved in this, is surrounding China militarily, politically, is stirring the pot in places like Xinjiang with the Uyghur Muslim minority there, in places like Hong Kong, through demonstrable links of certain Occupy Central members to the National Endowment for Democracy and other such links. That is going on, and that is part of a Cold War scenario that is playing out right now, that includes the increasing tensions in the Asia-Pacific region that we've talked about before and that I document on my website, where we see the so-called Asia-Pacific pivot that was announced by Hillary Clinton a few years ago, back when she was at the State Department, and which is going on to this day as we see the defense budgets of every single player in the region is ramping up at this point as they prepare for some sort of military conflict. So we see all of that going on, and I think that's the two-dimensional chess game. I think the third dimension is what you're talking about with the business interests and the links between the U.S. and China. And it is so important to understand that bigger picture that if we don't understand that, then we're going to lose the chess game altogether. And that goes into the history of the Chinese-U.S. relationship and how China came into the position, the economic and geopolitical and military position that it is in today. And that is through a series of coordinated efforts that have been made to build China into the economic juggernaut. It's not exactly an economic juggernaut at this point, but at least growing economic power that it is today, that could not have taken place without those coordinated efforts that have taken place over decades to do a number of different things. Build up the business and manufacturing infrastructure of China, which has been participated in by some of the biggest Fortune 500 corporations in the world, to change the tax regulations in the United States to incentivize the offshoring of labor and manufacturing to China in order to build up that manufacturing behemoth. And all of the political machinations that have made China into this sort of quasi-partner with the United States in various ways. And I think we can start to get a handle on that when we actually drill down into the types of people who are puppeteering, I think, this third dimension of the chessboard. And when you start to get into that, you start to look at, for example, just as one notable example, David Rockefeller, writing the obituary for Chairman Mao in the New York Times back in the 1970s, hailing his Cultural Revolution as one of the great social experiments of all time, and saying, you know, what a loss it is if that momentum is lost. Of course, the Cultural Revolution being referred to killed a conservatively 60 million. Most people put that more at 80 million. 80 million people snuffed out by the Chinese government during that glorious revolution. But of course, those types of details tend to be left out in those obituaries. Fast forward.
There were poor people who died, and that certainly wouldn't. I don't think that would. I don't think those count. Does it count when poor people die, or is it only rich people that matter?
One person dying is a tragedy. A million is a statistic. 80 million. Yeah. 80 million is a footnote, basically. So that's unfortunately how that works. But then, I mean, you extend that out into David Rockefeller's proteges and minions, for example, of course, Henry Kissinger, who has written a book on China and the U.S. and has on multiple occasions talked about China as a model for the New World Order. Or you look at George Soros on multiple occasions documented talking about China as the engine of the New World Order was the phrase that he used, and talking about how the economic powerhouse that has been created in China is going to be the model for what is to come in the financial system. And then, of course, I mean, there's all the political connotations that come with that in a dictatorial society with the enforced one-child policy and enforced abortions and things of that nature being a model for the political future of the United States and elsewhere as these systems start to merge, which was the bigger picture that was pointed out repeatedly by Anthony Sutton in his work first at the Hoover Institution and then as an independent scholar, writing about the ways that the Soviet Union and the Nazi Germany and the FDR presidency were all manipulated behind the scenes by the same banking interests that have a vested interest in keeping a sort of paper tiger enemy that they build up and use in this type of two-dimensional chess game. So, I it's extremely complicated. I'm going to be doing a podcast, hopefully in the next few weeks, about this and documenting the history of how China came into the position it is, so that we can understand that in this struggle, in this fight between the U.S. and China, I don't think there is a clean side. I don't think there's a good player in this game, because both sides are being controlled essentially, I think, by the same interests. Or if not controlled, at least, I think, puppeteered and string-pulled by the same interests that, again, are not working in the interests of the Chinese people or the American people or the people of anywhere else on the planet.
Then we're not really adversaries precisely so much as in-laws.
Yeah.
Would that be accurate description?
That might actually be a good analogy.
What are we actually fighting? If our government is antagonistic, or at least competitive, are we competing with China in the sense of a national entity that's been there for a long time, or are we promoting dissent in Hong Kong, ultimately to get at the Chinese government. Are we trying to overthrow something over there, lay the foundation for some sort of an internal revolution where China stays intact, but they have a different government before this is all over?
Well, again, I think that's the narrative that's being put forward by a lot of the people pointing out the NED connections to the umbrella revolution that's going on right now. That basically this is an attempt to install certain U.S.-backed or Washington-friendly interests in the Hong Kong executive position, which then would be a foil or a counterparty to what's happening in Beijing and could be kind of a foot in the door towards having a greater Washington influence in what's happening in China generally. So that would be, I suppose, that sort of 2D chess game version of what's happening there, and that would play into that idea that, again, these are adversaries in a type of Cold War scenario. But again, I mean, ultimately, I think that this has to be about the agency of the people of Hong Kong to choose for themselves what they are going to do. And that cannot happen when the Beijing government is telling them that they can, you can vote for anyone you like as long as it's one of these pre-selected candidates. So again, there's a bigger picture to what's happening here that we have to keep in mind.
We're going to take a break in just 15, 20 seconds, but quick answer. Do you think the government of China has regrets about expanding to where they became a supplier of manufacturing items for the United States?
That's an excellent question, and I really don't know about that. I don't, I mean, it's certainly, yeah.
You hit, I finally got
you
one.
You found it.
How
you
long
got
has it
it
taken me to get a question that you couldn't exactly answer? Frank, make sure you record that. We're going to take a break here, folks. We'll be back, talk a little more about China and whether they have regrets or they don't have regrets in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. We'll be right back. Hi, folks. I'm talking to James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com. Talking about when we were discussing the possibility that people in the Chinese government may be realizing that they've kind of been trapped by the United States and all the progress they made. Some of them may be longing from the good old days when they had just a straight-out communism. And some elements might be saying, listen, this is, we're making money, we have automobiles, but maybe this isn't our best choice. Now, I got excited because I finally asked a question that James couldn't exactly answer, so I interrupted there. But do you have anything else you'd like to add relative to that question, or should we move on?
Right. No, I'll take my crack at it, which is to say that there are, as you say, there are elements in society and in the Chinese government that have benefited from what's gone on and obviously want that to continue. And then there are other elements that I'm sure, as you say, are pining for some sort of glorified past, in which there was a much smaller elite that ruled more iron-fistedly over a much larger segment of the population. What we're seeing now really is the creation of a, not exactly, a middle class. I don't know if you could really transplant that idea onto the Chinese system, which is still very much centrally controlled, but at any rate, a burgeoning number of people who are making money and are obviously have a much higher standard of living. That comes at a great cost in a lot of other ways, societally, environmentally, and otherwise. But at any rate, that is happening. So those people are in somewhat invested in the system and want to see this continue. But I think, again, when we look at it from the perspective of that 3D chess game, as we were talking about before, it's the question of to what extent do the elements of the Chinese ruling class understand that they have been positioned and engineered into the position they're in by that regulatory and tax framework and all of those other ways, that international trade treaties and the other things that have made China into the juggernaut it is, and to what extent are they comfortable with that, knowing that that plug could be pulled at any time if that need was seen. So I don't have any window into the Chinese government. I don't know who's puppeteering what and who is aware of what's happening and all of those types of intrigues. But it's Like anything else, I would say there's different factions that exist, and I'm sure some of them are aware of what's going on and are probably uncomfortable with the fact that they are now in the position they're in because of the heavy investment of Fortune 500 companies and the tax framework of the United States and the international trade treaties they've signed and other such things, which have obviously changed the fabric of Chinese society.
I'd say, if I had to guess, that the principal agents of whatever it is that the United States is trying to impose on China would simply be the Chinese people who have become corporate executives. And they're able to make, I'm sure that some of them are making, fabulous incomes. And they have to have a kind of influence on the government that the bureaucrats are not familiar with and probably don't exactly know how to resist. It's almost as if we had taken one of those species that's under control in a foreign country, pythons, turned them loose in the Everglades. All right? We have a foreign invasive species. They are corporate executives. They don't have to be secret agents of the United States. They can be as patriotic Chinese as you could find, and yet just the interest in being a corporate executive is going to compel you into a certain kind of conflict with the bureaucrats that are running the Chinese government. Does that sound plausible, reasonable, or?
Yes. I mean, again, it's a complicated thing because the corruption, of course, goes both ways. And obviously, there's bribery and kickbacks that these local communist officials get in return for looking the other way on this or that violation. And then there's this interesting other phenomenon that's occurring with some degree of some type of communication possible on the heavily censored Chinese internet, where you have these so-called netizens, the growing number of Chinese people online in various Chinese social media, who take pictures of Chinese officials, for example, and examine them and see their Rolex watches and other things that they couldn't possibly afford on their salary, which becomes scandals, which ultimately unseat some of these officials. So there's an interesting dynamic going on there, but I think this is part of what's so opaque about it, is that we don't know the machinations that go on. And, you know, when there's a crackdown on corrupt officials at a local level from Beijing, I mean, to what extent is that politically motivated? To what extent is that just PR? There was that bizarre story a year or two ago that I'm not going to remember the details of off the top of my head, but it was a rising political star in the Chinese Communist Party who got completely taken out of the picture, got put up on corruption
charges. Did he have a wife who was accused of poisoning people?
Right. It was a bizarre story that started to spin out of control, and there's like a lot more to it, I'm sure.
Shakespearean, practically. It was
Lady Macbeth.
You know, like a Chinese version of Othello.
Yeah. It was Lady interesting. Macbeth, but again, that's the type of thing that, unless you have a window into the sort of backroom deliberations, I mean, it's probably impossible for us to piece that together from the outside.
Here's another one we can speculate on. Reuters has a headline, finance minister, they're talking about the finance minister of Russia, warns Russia can't afford military spending plan. Now, Russia's getting squeezed economically. Is this simply a natural result of perhaps Putin going too far with his plans? Or is this evidence that the economic sanctions the United States has attempted to place on Russia are having an effect?
Well, probably both. I mean, Russia is obviously being pressured into flexing more of its military might, if only in terms of military drills and what have you at the moment. But of course, that involves a great degree of preparedness. And obviously, the Russian government is still continuing to have to try to maintain and even increase their military forces in the wake of all of this turmoil, including the turmoil right on their doorstep in Ukraine. So that requires a lot more expenditure, and add to that the sanctions that have been put in place that are having an effect on the Russian economy. And yes, it creates a perfect storm, I suppose, of kind of bankrupting the Russian government piece by piece. And we're starting to see the beginnings of that. And it really, again, it brings into focus the question of who could really compete with the U.S. and its allies, NATO, basically, militarily, on the world stage. Absolutely no one. I mean, the United States has whatever the figure is, I recently tweeted an infographic with the exact numbers, but it's something like the military budget of the next whatever 10 biggest military powers combined. So
I agree. We have an enormous military budget, and it's not just competitive. The rest of the world couldn't possibly keep up with us, at least individual nations. There's no way at this time. They cannot compete. Now, they may find some remarkable technology. You can imagine that China, for example, got a lot of intellectual potential over there. They could develop some bizarre new technology, and all of a sudden we'd give us a real run for the money. But for the moment, it's a little like you talked earlier. We've got a certain amount of a paper tiger there. And they're not as powerful as perhaps a lot of people suspect. I've seen the price of crude oil has fallen significantly in the last 6 or 8 weeks. Do you think that fall, and it's surprising given the problems we have in the Middle East, it's explained, according to some, by increased U.S. production? But I wonder myself if the falling price of crude oil is simply a consequence of increased supply and diminished global demand just because the economies are in a rut? Or is this being done and manipulated intentionally to put Russia in a bind? Much of their income.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a very important point. Right. No, that's an important observation. And in fact, oilprice.com had an article just a couple of months ago, dropping oil prices threaten Moscow's budget. And the exact point they're making is what you're talking about there. I mean, obviously, the Russian economy relies largely on the oil and gas benefits that Russia has from its natural resources. Falling oil price is definitely bad for Russia in those terms. So I don't know whether or not the falling oil price is being used is being created as a type of geopolitical warfare, but it has that effect, whatever the case may be. So it certainly is important geopolitically in that respect. And I mean, there are a number of factors that go into that, including what obviously has happened in the last few years of shale oil production, which has formed that glut in the refineries in the United States and has contributed to the falling price. I mean, there are certain reasons why it is rational that the price has fallen, but it does have those political implications.
Well, one of the other points that's interesting to me is the price of oil is falling more or less at the time when Russia and China are attempting to negotiate a pipeline or a series of pipelines where Russia is going to be supplying more crude oil to China. And do you suppose that the current falling prices have any effect on the pipeline negotiations?
They would. They certainly would, wouldn't they? And I am not familiar with those types of deals. I think you've hit on another thing that I'm not knowledgeable about, which is how these types of deals
two
are.
Two in a row. Well, two in the same program.
Oh, my God. I'm slipping. Yep. I'm not familiar with how those deals are structured. Obviously, they would have to take into account the market prices because you wouldn't want to lock in on some 20-year deal at a certain price and then the price plummets or rises. So there must be some way that is factored in there. It would have an effect, obviously, on the negotiations, but at this point, I mean, it's not a precipitous plummeting of prices. And if you look at the trends over the past 3 years, there has been a couple of spikes and a couple of falls, and the current plunge in the latter half of 2014 is not a huge dip on the graph. It's noticeable, but it's not huge. So I think at this point, we're not seeing a major disruption in oil prices, nothing like what we saw a few years ago with the price plummeting precipitously, back when everyone was thinking it was going to go to $200 a barrel. Suddenly it went the exact other way. We haven't seen anything like that that would really throw a major monkey wrench into the works.
I've got another one over in Iran. We have the Parchin facility. It's a military camp located about 15 kilometers east of Tehran. Research is conducted on the production of explosives, missile warheads, as well as some activities associated with a nuclear weapons group. They have reportedly had an explosion in the last little while. And I'm reading a report that says the West will know within a few days what caused the explosion at the Iranian military complex. And it says the magnitude of the explosion, which left two people dead and several wounded, the flash and the huge blast felt many kilometers away leave no room for doubt that this facility is related to a nuclear program. Now, they don't know. They're just saying is related to a nuclear program. They're not alleging that this was a nuclear blast. And yet they are alleging some relationship. Is this relationship legitimate? Is it valid? Or is it just hyperbole where people are sitting back and say, let's try to create evidence that the Iranians are making nuclear weapons?
Well, I would take any of these reports that come out about Iran's facilities with a grain of salt, because there is going to be obfuscation on both sides of this. And it's going to be difficult to come to a conclusion, even if the facts, even if they were revealed in some sort of IAEA report, the reporting of those facts would undoubtedly become skewed in the process of reporting. So it's there's always so many layers of obfuscation going on. Parchin is interesting because it's been one of those sticking points in the negotiations about IAEA access to facilities around Iran and whether Iran is complying with IAEA requests. Parchin has been one of those facilities that has been mentioned specifically. So the fact that there was this explosion at that facility in particular is, well, whatever, however it happened, again, is convenient, I think, for the people that want greater access to the Iranian nuclear program. And so, again, I don't know whether they're, I mean, I'm assuming they're going to come out with something saying this was in some way related to nuclear production. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to be...
It's no surprise.
Yeah, the only way that that story
will
play out.
Yellow cake and centrifuges and...
Exactly.
Anything that goes bang in the dark, it's evidence of nuclear. We've got maybe a minute left, so maybe one last question. How do you rate Obama and the Obama administration? Is he just incompetent, or is he one of the sharpest operators around, or at least his administration, insofar as they are manipulating Russia, they're manipulating China? Who's smart?
I would say Obama's just a stuffed suit. I don't put a lot of stock in the idea that that the presidents really run things in the way that the popular imagination has it. I mean, even not even talking from the conspiratorial angle about the shadow government, but I mean, just even talking about the way the administration functions, I just think the president is a teleprompter reader and doesn't even do a great job at that. But his administration, is it crafty? Does it have some sort of, you know, purpose that it's aiming at? I think on the surface, absolutely not. It seems to be flailing about and reacting to events in incompetent
rather
ways, whether it's Ebola or ISIS or what have you. But again, I think that's because the administration is not necessarily what's in control of the U.S. political apparatus. And I think
you're going to have to let it go at that, James. I want to thank you again for being on the program, but we are out of time. And I want to thank all you folks for listening. My guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. I'm Alfred Addisk. Be back mañana. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Right.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.